strong from the older generation, and it's related to the modern Irish word seanchi, or storyteller. Sometimes dinchenicus can seem rather random, like the storyteller is going a long way to get there. Sometimes, though, these stories are very well integrated into the plot. For example, in the Toyn, the hero Cuchulainn, who is defying the men of Connacht, comes to a ford called Athgrena, the Sunny Ford. He lays down a challenge to his enemies by cutting the fork of a tree with one stroke of his sword. He uses the fork to carve a message of defiance in Ogham's script. When four of his enemies nevertheless approach him, he cuts off all four of their heads and sticks them on the four prongs of the fork. The ford is renamed Athgavla, the ford of the fork, ever after. This is a very memorable story. You won't forget the name of that ford, probably ever, because you will have a mental image of four heads spiked on a tree branch. The reason this kind of story mattered, of course, is that Ireland was a society without maps. These stories were their maps, and they were so specific and so evocative that we can now actually trace in the landscape where many of these stories supposedly took place. It's a very striking fact about early Irish literature that it is tied so closely to the landscape of Ireland. Another noticeable feature of Irish literature is that it tends to fall into very specific genres. In fact, we have several surviving tale lists from the Middle Ages that put the early Irish tales into these categories. For example, you know, we might have a broad category such as the rom-com or the bromance. The Irish had a category called the Death of Kings, which was pretty much what you would think it was. This practice of putting tales into very specific mental pigeonholes surely helped the bards to remember them. This way, if somebody requested a tale about the death of a king, say, or about a voyage to the other world, or the elopement of two lovers, these are all actual genres, the bard would be able to pull out of his memory various examples of the genre in question. I just want to mention one more characteristic of Irish tales that might have been implicit in the category called the Death of Kings. It is the fact that these Irish tales are not like a modern page-turner. Not at all. We are not meant to be surprised by the ending. In fact, almost everybody hearing the tale will know the ending, and it is often given away at the start of the story. Suspense is not the point. Novelty is not the point. This is a tradition that is focused mostly on preserving stories that have value in the present, not about inventing something new. Now, the multitude of medieval classifications for these tales can be somewhat unwieldy to work with. So instead, modern scholars have grouped these tales into four big cycles that are distinguished more by subject matter rather than by tale type. So there is more than one tale type in each of these cycles. But I think it will be easier to keep the tale straight if we follow the modern distinctions rather than the medieval ones. The four big cycles, in roughly chronological order, are as follows. First, the mythological cycle, which covers the peopling of Ireland and the early clashes between the early inhabitants and various supernatural beings. Second, the Ulster cycle, which deals with the conflict between two provinces of Ireland, Ulster and Connacht, especially with the great cattle raid that is the subject of the Irish epic, the Toyn. Third, the King Tales, which take place during the early centuries after the conversion of Ireland to Christianity. Some of these are probably based on real events and real kings, even if a little bit loosely. And fourth, the Oisín cycle. These are tales that take place in the later medieval period concerning the great warrior Finn MacCool and his band of companions, as well as Finn's son, Oisín. I'm going to discuss the first three cycles in this lecture, and the fourth in a later lecture on the discovery of the Celts in early modern Europe, because it's an important part of that story. Let's start with the first of these cycles, the mythological cycle. This cycle is important for scholars for various reasons, but perhaps mostly because this is one of the only places we can look to try to recover something of pre-Christian Irish religion or mythology. The tales take place in a distant pre-Christian past, and they include many supernatural elements. And in fact, the supernatural is not far to seek in Irish literature generally, but it is particularly pronounced in the mythological cycle. One of the most important threads in this cycle includes the stories of the peopling of Ireland that came to be known as the Leabhar Gabhála Éireann, or the Book of Invasions. I have talked in general terms about this text in my lecture on early Irish history, but here I want to describe in more detail two closely related tales from this tradition, because I think they give us a good sense of this material. The two tales are called the First Battle of Moytura and the Second Battle of Moytura. And due to the very specific place name lore contained in the tales, we know where they are set. The first is near Cong in County Mayo, and the second is by Lough Arrow in County Sligo. We're told that the people known as the Nemedians have left Ireland in three separate groups to escape the Fomorian giants. First, one of these groups, the Firbolg, returns to Ireland from exile in Greece and conquers the Fomorians. But then a second group, known as the Tuatha De Danann, arrives. The Tuatha are just a little bit magic. And in fact, they may be members of an original pagan pantheon. Under the leadership of their king, Nuada, the Tuatha arrive in Ireland to demand that the Firbolg either face them in battle or concede half of the island to them. Of course, the choice is for battle, and Nuada ends up facing the champion of the Firbolg, a man named Sreng. Sreng cuts off Nuada's right hand, but the Tuatha win the battle. They call a truce and once again give the Firbolg the choice of whether to continue fighting, leave Ireland altogether, or share the island with the Tuatha. Sreng proposes a single combat with Nuada, but Nuada will only agree to fight if Sreng will bind up one of his arms so that the two men are fighting on an even playing field. Sreng refuses, and the Firbolg are confined to the province of Connacht, leaving the rest of the island to the Tuatha. It's a little weird so far, but it's about to get weirder. One of the Tuatha, Dianchecht, who was pretty clearly a god of healing, gives Nuada a new artificial hand, which earns Nuada the nickname of Nuada Argetlav, or Nuada of the Silver Hand. But it turns out that kings cannot have any physical blemishes, because they need to represent the integrity of the people. So for 7 years, the Tuatha are ruled by a different king named Bres, who is part Tuatha, part Fomorian giant. Once Bres dies, Nuada's arm is restored, and he is put back on the throne. Now we come to the Second Battle of Moytura, which is kind of a sequel, except not really, because some details are changed. Here we find that Bres is more of a villain. His Fomorian ancestry causes him to oppress the Tuatha, and he also fails to offer the kind of hospitality expected of a king. So Bres is deposed, and Nuada's flesh regrows over his silver arm. So he is restored to the throne. The big difference between the stories is that in the first story, Nuada is restored because Bres dies, but in the second story, Bres is deposed. So Bres leads a counter-revolution with the help of a Fomorian named Balor of the Evil Eye. In the ensuing battle, Nuada is killed, but a new Tuatha champion named Lugh is triumphant. Bres survives, and his life is spared on the condition that he teach the rather artsy Tuatha how to farm, which he does. This does not make a whole lot of sense. We have signs that at least two versions of the story must have circulated, and we also suspect that what we see here are gods who have been dumbed down into human form. Lugh, for example, has a name that clearly links him to the continental Celtic god who gave his name to many places across Europe, including Lugdunum in France, which is modern Lyon. The point, though, is that these are fundamentally tales about the right way to rule. Kings who do not meet their subjects' expectations can expect to face a challenge. If the mythological cycle takes place at some sort of early phase of the settlement of Ireland, the next cycle I want to talk about, the Ulster cycle, belongs to a slightly more recognizable, but still pre-Christian past. The most famous story in the cycle, the Toine, or, as it is often translated into English, the cattle raid of Cooley. It has been described as a window on the Iron Age because it seems to record conditions in Ireland right before the conversion of Ireland to Christianity. The Toine has also been referred to as the Irish Iliad, and in fact, the parallels are kind of close. Just like the Iliad, the Toine starts with a kidnapping, but instead of a queen, the victim is a bull, the brown bull of Cooley. And just as in the Iliad, a war is fought to recover the victim. The Toine also has its heroes, the most important of which by far is Cuchulainn, who is at the same time one of the most impressive and most bizarre heroes in all of epic literature. He has some traits in common with Achilles. For example, neither Cuchulainn nor Achilles is a mere mortal. But whereas with Achilles it's a pretty straightforward case of a mortal woman conceiving a child with a god, Cuchulainn's case is much more complicated. Cuchulainn represents a wonderful example of a very distinctive trait in Irish literature, namely the multiple conception of the hero. Let me run through the details because I think this will make it quite clear how unclear the story is. We start with the king of Ulster named Conovar, who is confronted with a plague of 90 birds who eat the crops of the Ulstermen. So he goes out with his followers in chariots to drive the birds away. The king's daughter, Dechtina, is with him, since she is his charioteer. The birds are in fact driven away, but we know right away that there is something unusual about the birds, because each pair of birds is linked by a silver chain. That is a clear sign that they are supernatural. Three birds break away and make for the Bruna Boyne, which refers to the area where the passage graves can be found by the River Boyne. And I should point out here that the early Irish were absolutely fascinated by these megalithic monuments. They just didn't know anything more about them than we do, since they were already thousands of years old. Then the men of Ulster sought shelter in a nearby house where a woman was giving birth, and Dechtina went to help her, and she ended up nursing the baby boy. The next morning, they woke to find the house and the mother and father of the boy were gone, and only the boy remained. The boy was taken back to Ulster, but after some years in Dechtina's care, he died, and she was greatly saddened. Dechtina requested water, and every time she went to drink it, a tiny creature would leap from the water towards her lips, but once she took the vessel away, there was nothing there. That night she dreamed that a man called Lugh, notice the name, told her that he was the one who had brought her to the Brugh and that she was pregnant by him. And Dechtina did prove to be pregnant, which perturbed the Ulstermen because they thought she was pregnant by her own father, the king. To deal with the embarrassment, the men of Ulster married off Dechtina to a man called Saltif. But because Dechtina thought it was improper to go to one man's bed while pregnant by another, she lay down on the bed and crushed the child within her. And then she became pregnant by her new husband and had a son. The strangest part of all of this is that somehow, even though the first two children die, they are both also Cuchulainn, which means that he is somehow the son of the god Lugh. Achilles' conception and birth may be supernatural, but it is a lot simpler. And if we continue the comparison between Cuchulainn and Achilles, we might look at their physical descriptions. Achilles is conventionally handsome. Cuchulainn is not. This is how he is described in the Toine. His hair was arranged in three layers, dark next to the scalp, blood red in the middle, and yellow at the ends, which were set like a gold crown on his head, falling to the nape of the neck in a braid of three coils, with little ringlets and gold shiny strands combed out in artful disarray about his shoulders. 100 curls of purple gold shone round his neck. 100 amber beaded ribbons bedecked his head. He had 4 dimples in each cheek, yellow, green, blue, and purple. 7 brilliant gems gleamed in each regal eye. Each foot had 7 toes, and each hand 7 fingers, the nails or claws or talons of each with the grip of a hawk or a griffin. And this is Cuchulainn on a good day. When his battle rage is on him, he goes into what translators have variously called his warp spasm or his torque, which is some kind of frightening contortion that has a dramatic effect on an already unusual-looking young man. His hair stood on end. You'd think each hair had been hammered into his head. Each hair seemed tipped with a spark, so sharply did they shoot upright. He closed one eye, as narrow as the eye of a needle. He opened the other, as wide as the mouth of a goblet. He bared his teeth from ear to ear. He opened his gob so wide you could see the inside of his gullet. The hero's light sprang from the crown of his head. Needless to say, he is pretty close to unbeatable, especially when his torque is on him. Alongside Cuchulainn, the most compelling character in the Toyn is undoubtedly Maeve, Queen of Connacht. It is Maeve, after all, who starts off the whole story of the cattle raid because she is jealous of her husband's bull. I have more to say about Maeve in my lecture on social structure and the role of women in Celtic society, so I'll leave her aside for now, except to say that she seems to be descended from a goddess figure linked to sovereignty and intoxication. The Ulster cycle ends with the victory of the Ulstermen over Connacht, but in the process, huge slaughter is done on both sides, and the brown bull is killed. Maeve's jealousy has had terrible consequences, but she has at least allowed for our hero to show himself at his most heroic. But the text is not just about fighting. It is about the pain caused when men are forced to preserve their honor at the cost of rupturing some of the closest social bonds known to Irish society. Cuchulainn tries in vain to avoid fighting his foster brother, Ferdia, but he cannot do so without shame, and so he chooses to kill Ferdia, but his heart is broken. So now I want to move on to the third cycle, the Tales of the Irish Kings. Here we have a recognizable, though still ancient, Christianized Ireland, although there's still a lot of mythological material. And it's clear that the transition to Christianity has not been seamless. The reason these tales are so important is that they have a serious point to make about the proper exercise of kingship in Ireland. Let's look at kingship at two points in its life cycle, as the tales do, when a king takes the throne and when he dies. I want to talk now about one of the most important Irish myths, the myth of the goddess of sovereignty. The goddess of sovereignty was the embodiment of the right to rule, and it was the goddess who conveyed this right on individual rulers. You needed the approval of the goddess if you were going to be a successful king whom everyone acknowledged as the rightful king. This myth is absolutely essential to Irish literature. We will see it crop up again and again throughout the rest of these lectures. Let me give you a quick summary of one of its most important appearances. In this story, we have a familiar situation in Irish literature. Namely, there is a king's son who is trying to make his way in the world, but he is the youngest in a large family of brothers. And moreover, his mother is not the official wife of the king, but rather a servant of lower status. So he's got something to prove. The name of the youngest brother is Niall. One day, he is out with his older half-brothers, and they come across a hideous old woman. She offers them a drink from her well, but she is only willing to give them the water if they will pay a small price. She wants a kiss. Now, she is totally loathsome to look at. None of the brothers want to kiss her. But the youngest brother leaps at the opportunity. He says that not only will he kiss her, he will lie with her as well. He has demonstrated his good faith, and at that moment, the loathsome hag is transformed into a beautiful young woman. And presumably only after the transformation does Niall have to carry through on his promise to the ex-hag. It turns out, of course, that the woman represents the sovereignty of Ireland. And Niall does go on to become king. In fact, the very famous king known as Niall of the Nine Hostages. So what do we make of this story? It's famous in later literature as the central motif of the Wife of Bath's tale in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. but in Ireland it had a very important political meaning. The idea was that sovereignty was hard to acquire but beautiful to keep. For the Irish, stories of this kind were deeply political. Literature in Ireland was never just for entertainment. Of course, people in early Ireland were sophisticated consumers of these literary traditions. They could recognize a good allegory when they saw one. They did not believe that the goddess literally chose the successful claimant for the throne. But these stories about the sovereignty goddess helped to ratify the results of what could be an extremely messy and even bloody process. Many stories of the sovereignty goddess are about acquiring the throne, but a lot of them are also about losing the throne. That is, they fall into the enormous genre I mentioned earlier, the death of kings. The most famous of these is the tale of the destruction of Dádarga's hostel, in which an unjust king is punished for violating his responsibility to provide equal justice to his subjects. In this story, King Conor is promised that if he avoids violating certain gesa or taboos, such as not allowing three red-headed men to precede him into the house of a red-headed man, he will be a successful king. So Conor rules justly, and as a result, the land flourishes. But Conor has a problem. His foster brothers. They are not good men. In fact, they are criminals. And Conor is caught between his duty to punish wrongdoers and his personal obligation to his foster brothers. So rather than treat them as they deserve, he merely banishes them. But they continue to raid Conor's kingdom, and as a result, the good omens of Conor's early reign are reversed. The weather worsens, and the crops wither. And Conor is forced repeatedly to violate the gesa that he was told he must not violate. Conor is drawn into a final battle against the marauders, and he is killed. It's a strange story, full of the kinds of digressions I mentioned earlier, but it's also interesting for another reason I mentioned, which is that we are never in any doubt about what is going to happen. When we are told what Conor's gesa are, we know he will violate them all, and that he is doomed. When faced with a moral dilemma, he chose wrong, and the story punishes him for it. The king tales were very much meant, I think, as cautionary tales for contemporary kings. Of course, the actual kings who heard these stories were not really worrying about whether three red-headed people were entering a house before them. But they probably were worrying, and rightly so, about the political temperature in the room when the tale was being told. As we've seen, Irish literature tends to concentrate on things not being quite what they seem. Narratives are disjointed. Time and place don't work quite the way we expect them to. And even the process of giving birth is far more complicated than it is in everyday life. If you're looking for realism, this is not your literature. But in these texts, we get a fascinating glimpse of what this society valued. Mighty deeds, sure, but also honor and justice.
Lecture 15, Celtic Women, Families, and Social Structure.
Welcome back. In this lecture, we're going to discuss the society of the Celtic lands in the early Middle Ages. How was it organized? What were some of its distinctive institutions? What was the role of the family in this society? We'll talk quite a bit in this lecture about the role of law and lawyers in Celtic society for two closely related reasons. First, law was clearly very important to these societies. And second, we know this because we have so many surviving legal texts. So while many people associate the Celts with literature and art, and rightly so, we should keep in mind that the law was just as important. Finally, we'll talk a bit about the role of women in Celtic societies, since this is a topic that has received quite a bit of attention from scholars and from the general public in recent years. Were women better off in Celtic societies than in some other cultures? We'll see that the evidence is not clear-cut, but it certainly is intriguing. Most of the evidence I will talk about in this lecture comes from Ireland, but some is from Wales. Let's start by making a general statement that applies to both Wales and Ireland. In both places, as early as we can see it in any detail, we have a notable unity in culture, but a fragmentation in politics. This is far different from what we find in, say, early Anglo-Saxon England. As a result, it is far easier to say something about what society was like in early Ireland and Wales than it is to say who exactly was running it. So most of what I have to say will be about the structure of society, not about individual rulers. In order to help us organize our thoughts about this society, I am going to use a basic description of early Ireland that every scholar of Ireland knows by heart, though it applies in most senses to Wales as well. The great historian Daniel Binchy claimed in 1954 that early Ireland was tribal, rural, hierarchical, and familiar. And this statement has been refined and criticized since, but I think it's essentially true, and it's a useful way of organizing the information. So I'm going to follow this fourfold schema, but I'm actually going to use a different order than Binchy does. So apologies to Daniel Binchy. Let's start with the first term in Binchy's definition, tribal. Binchy was not using the word in any sort of technical anthropological sense. What he means here is that Ireland was composed of many small units or kingdoms, possibly at least 100 at any one time. These kings, or ríche, ruled over tuatha, which means not kingdoms, but rather peoples. If you remember from my lecture on Irish literature, the supernatural characters who figure in the mythological cycle are known as the tuatha de Danann, the peoples of the goddess Danu. So these kingdoms consisted of small kin groups, all owing allegiance to the ruler. As we saw in previous lectures, the succession was often hotly disputed among the relatives of the previous ruler, so the politics of these small units was frequently very convoluted. This is why it was a good idea to have an origin story in which the future king kissed the goddess of sovereignty. This papered over some rather brutal faction fights, which often occurred within the royal family. Besides these tiny kingdoms, Ireland was also very loosely divided into bigger units called provinces, and these are referred to in the early sources. But they don't have fixed borders, and they're not concrete political entities. They're more like geographical ideas. There were at various points 4 or 5 of these provinces. In the early period, the word for province is coicheth, which means a fifth. And this is still the word for province in Irish today, but nowadays there are only 4 left. Ulster is in the north, Connacht in the west, Leinster in the southeast, and Munster in the southwest. The middle province was called Meath, which just means middle, but it has been absorbed by the other 4. Today there's a county Meath, but not a province. There were no political entities, thus, that covered the whole country. Your political loyalty would have probably been very localized indeed. It would be determined by your relationship to the king, or rí, of your own tuath. And that might be a group of only a few thousand people. With such a fragmented society, it won't surprise you to learn that there were no real cities in early Ireland. This is the second part of Binchy's definition, that Ireland is rural. This was not as true for some of the other Celtic-speaking areas as it was for Ireland. In Ireland, people lived in widely scattered settlements, either in homesteads where there was an enclosure, that was if they were somewhat wealthy, or simply in isolated farms. We know a lot more about these enclosures. In Ireland, they're usually called ring forts. But they weren't really forts, since they were not usually placed on the highest ground available to be defensible. The most common type of ring fort was called the rath. It was surrounded by a bank and an impressive outer ditch. Occasionally, there were 2 or more walls, usually made of earth. The enclosures were not huge. About 100 feet in diameter was typical. Another type of ring fort was built with stone. This is the cashel. And you see these mostly in the west, where the landscape is rockier. And you do tend to find these on higher ground. We're not sure exactly why. They're built with dry stone walls, usually without ditches. A final kind of enclosure I want to mention is the dune, which is a more elaborate stone structure, often with separate concentric stone rings. And these may have been intended for defense. For example, Dún Éingus on Inishmore in the Aran Islands is on the edge of a high cliff, so a seaborne invasion would have been extremely difficult. And outside of its concentric walls, it has a very elaborate system of stone slabs that would have constituted a formidable barrier to anyone attacking from the land. But some scholars have suggested that a site like Dún Éingus could have been used for ritual purposes, like a sort of amphitheater. The fact is that we don't have enough evidence to decide, and perhaps the site was used for both defense and ritual. But sites like Dún Éingus are comparatively rare. They would have taken a lot of resources, and very few people in early Ireland commanded that much labor. Houses, whether inside or outside of enclosures, were usually round and made of wood and wicker. And you can actually visit a reconstruction of these houses at the Irish National Heritage Park in County Wexford, where you can stay overnight in a ring fort. There's one last kind of dwelling I want to mention. It's called a cranog, and it was, by definition, found on an island, in a lake. This is a very old tradition in Ireland that goes back to the late Bronze Age and continued well into the Christian period, and you can visit a modern reconstruction of a cranog in County Clare. A cranog's island might be natural, or it might be artificial. Now, it was a very labor-intensive process to create an artificial island, so cranogs must have been at least partly intended for defense. It would have a causeway connecting it to the mainland that could be removed if necessary to defend against attack. But this could also have been a way to assert status. You have the resources to build a cranog. So who lived in these dwellings, whether they were cranogs or ring forts or simpler houses? Largely, we're talking about family groups. So here is where we get to the third term in Binchy's definition, familiar, as in family-centered. And it's clear that the family, not the individual, was the basic unit of Irish society. There was a precise definition of the family for legal purposes. It was called the finne, or kin group, and it extended to more or fewer members depending on the particular situation involved. And this is not so different from today. We probably all have different family groups that we include for different purposes. Who do you invite for Thanksgiving dinner? Who do you invite to your cousin's wedding? Who just gets an announcement in the mail? That sort of thing. But for the Irish, these things were not mere social issues. They were matters of law and property. What did it mean to belong to the finne? Well, it gave you rights. You had the right to inherit land within this group. But it also brought responsibilities. The kin group had to consult each other about the distribution or sale of property, and also stand with each other in the face of legal disputes. I'll talk about both land and the law in turn. Let's start with land. The finne was often given the specific name der finne, which literally meant certain kin. And this meant all the relatives who went back to a common great-grandfather. So that's four generations. This was the usual group that would be involved in inheriting land and property. So what you possessed was almost entirely determined by your family ties. It was a male-centered group because a married woman belonged to the der finne of her husband. All the men in this group had some potential share in the land of the kindred, and it was this group that could normally compete for the rulership of the tuath. Inheritance was not determined by the marital status of the parents. There was no hard and fast line between legitimate and illegitimate offspring, as long as the father acknowledged paternity. And the family had to approve all major property transfers. To a certain extent, Everything was family property, and you had to get the consent of the group to allow a sale to go through. So there were serious pressures to come to satisfactory arrangements. This was one aspect of Irish property law that the later English colonizers of Ireland really had a hard time with, because, understandably, it seriously complicated questions of ownership and clear title. What about the family and the law? The Irish legal system, about which I'll talk more in a moment, was entirely based on what we would think of as civil law rather than criminal law. And that's perhaps not surprising in a highly fragmented society with very rudimentary government institutions. In other words, it was all about the lawsuit. People sued each other for things that would be considered criminal offenses today, like murder and assault. These matters were handled as private transactions between the parties. But it was the two kin groups who settled the dispute, not the two individuals, because the losing party in the suit got to hit up his relatives to help him pay the damages he owed to the winner. Your contribution was prorated based on the closeness of your relationship to the offender. Now, this system was a real incentive to keep your difficult cousin Yochi in line. If he caused trouble, you were going to have to pay for it. On the upside, if someone killed one of your relatives, it was payday. Okay? You got a full share of the compensation for the death of a parent, a half for a paternal uncle or maternal aunt, and a third for a cousin. Now, you wouldn't be rewarded directly for getting rid of your cousin Yochi, because there was no compensation for murders within the Fine. No one knows how these issues played out in practice. Probably some relatives had more influence within the kin group than others. But the basic principle is that the family is in it together. But a family could also be artificially extended by the institution of fosterage, in which children were raised by another family, sometimes from quite early ages. And this often resulted in lifelong ties of friendship that could be very useful in economic and political relationships later in life. Fosterage was pervasive in all the Celtic-speaking lands. It could be done inside or outside of the kin group. And we often see friendships between foster family members very movingly depicted in literature, particularly when the obligations of fosterage come into conflict with some other important obligation. For example, as I mentioned in my lecture on Irish literature, in the Toyne, the great Ulster hero Cuchulainn is forced by reasons of honor to fight against his foster brother Ferdia. The combat goes on for 3 days, and the two warriors speak in very moving verse about their love for each other and how loath they are to harm each other. But Cuchulainn inevitably does kill Ferdia, to his great sorrow. And the plot of the great tale from the King's Cycle, the destruction of Dádarga's hostel, turns on King Conor's reluctant decision to give special preference to his criminal foster brothers. And this failure to put strong personal ties aside for the good of his kingdom causes Conor's destruction. Fosterage could be between families of equal status, but it could also take place between families of unequal status. It was a sign of favor for a lord to ask his follower to foster his child. And it was also a huge benefit to a lower status person to be raised in a wealthier household. And that brings me to the final characteristic of Irish society, the fact that it was hierarchical. Families varied greatly in status, as they did in many medieval societies, and much of your daily existence was determined by where you stood in this hierarchy. This status was fixed according to two main criteria, wealth and occupation, and this had serious financial implications. I just said that kin groups had to help pay compensation for the injuries inflicted by their members. What determined the total price? It was the social status of the victim. The more important they were, the more you had to pay for injuring them. The price was expressed in a unit called the covil. which was worth either one slave girl or three cows. Right here, you can see that slavery was a major part of this society, if slave girls are considered a monetary unit. We'll come back to this when we talk about the status of women. The price was meant to compensate for the loss of the victim's honor, or enech, literally face, so loss of face, which is an expression we commonly use today. You could lose face not just by being physically injured, but also by being merely insulted. And the Irish apparently spent an awful lot of time dissing each other and then suing over it. Of course, the lawsuits were meant as a substitute for the other main recourse we know of when people diss each other, namely violence. And it's plain that there was a lot of that as well. It was a society that was very touchy on the subject of honor, and certainly people still feel this way. In 1987, Ronald Reagan's Irish-American Secretary of Labor, Raymond Donovan, was accused of corruption, but ultimately cleared. When he walked out of court, he asked reporters, "Which office do I go to get my reputation back?" His Irish ancestors would have had an answer for him, and they would have known exactly how much his reputation cost. So what were the major divisions that determined how much it would cost to insult you in ancient Ireland? Well, kings were in a class of their own, virtually, but once Christianity took root, they were not quite alone at the top. Bishops were given the same status as kings, and the highest poets belonged in that category too. Underneath kings and bishops, society was divided into three main groups. Nobles, the learned classes, and farmers. Slaves were at the bottom, of course, and they had no honor price, per se. Compensation for slaves was treated as a simple property matter. I'll start with the nobles. They varied in importance based on how wealthy they were, meaning how many cows they had, since that was the real touchstone of wealth in this period, as you can see in the toin. But also, it was reckoned by how many clients they had. Now, what in this context is a client? The word in Irish is Céile, or Kelly. So the many people with the surname Kelly are named for people in this very important relationship of subordination in early Ireland. But before the Kellys get too insulted, let me say that there could be very rich and important people, even nobles themselves, who were also clients. So what's clientship? First of all, it's a relationship that distinguishes nobles from commoners. Nobles can be clients without losing their noble status. I'll explain that in a minute. But you can't be a noble without having clients yourself. In other words, you must have people depending on you if you want to be able to call yourself a noble. It was a relationship that could benefit both sides. Clients received from the noble usually a piece of land, some cattle to start with, legal help if necessary, and, very important, protection from violence. In return, the noble was entitled to various things from the client based on the status of the client. Labor service, cattle, dairy products, grain, malt, meat. So the noble got someone to work his land and give him part of the proceeds. There were two main kinds of clientship, free clientship and base clientship. Base here means low or servile status, like in baseborn. Free clients would usually get a larger piece of land, perhaps an entire enclosure with accompanying farmland. It was a transaction that did not imply social subordination, and it could be ended at the mutual convenience of the parties. The price for that freedom, though, was that rents were higher than for base clients, but often the people who entered into this were people who could afford it. The duties demanded of free clients were fairly light. They had to show respect to the Lord by attending him and rising when he entered the room. So, essentially, you had to be part of an entourage when the Lord needed to impress people. And you did have to provide some labor services, but it was understood that usually you would have your people, your own dependents, take care of this for you. One of the chief purposes of free clientship was to create and extend the social network beyond the kin group, just as fosterage did. Of course, the free clients also formed part of the Lord's war band. Base clientship was a much more lopsided arrangement, and it created ties of economic dependency between the client and the noble. The noble would give the base client cattle and tools to sort of set him up on his own, and by doing so, the noble was essentially purchasing the honor price of the client. The client was now legally dependent on his lord, and he had to pay to get out of the agreement if he wanted to end it early. In exchange, the lord got a steady food supply and free labor. The client paid a rent in food and other farm products. The labor services demanded of base clients were more onerous and, one might imagine, a bit more humiliating. Besides typical farm labor, they included digging the grave mound of the lord and attending a commemorative funeral feast in his honor, which, depending on how popular the lord had been, might have been quite a party. Base clients also had some military obligations, including patrolling the borders of their lord's land and going on an expedition called a garmslúch, or hosting. This was a very important Irish phenomenon, so I'll just define it quickly in passing. Since Ireland was so decentralized and the borders were so fluid, people would gather their armed men and make an expedition into the territory of a subordinate ruler or even of an enemy, basically to show the flag, to show that they could. Sometimes there would be fighting, sometimes not. But if you were a client, you had to go along. So what was in it for the base clients? In a very dangerous society, it helped a lot to be able to rely on a strong man for protection. And they did pay lower rents than the free clients. It seems to have worked fairly well for both sides, because the institution persisted for centuries in virtually the same form. Now, what did nobles do when they weren't policing their clients? They hunted a lot, and afterwards they feasted quite a bit, and you can see this all over the tales. One of the best and funniest Irish tales is the story of a feast put on by a mischievous man named Bricru, who deliberately stirs up rivalry between the heroes of Ulster over who should be awarded the champion's portion, the best cuts of meat and best drink at the feast he puts on in Ulster. It helps to know that the name Bricru means poison tongue. The story is a masterful satire of how status-conscious the Irish were, and it ends up with the women of Ulster joining in this competition for status in a hilariously undignified manner, and everyone is brawling, a real Donnybrook, to be somewhat anachronistic. So that's a little bit about what we think early Irish society was like. It's stratified, it's rural, and it's very much organized around the family. But there are also these other institutions, like fosterage and clientship, that are designed to give people ties outside their families. These are the ties that bind in early Irish society. But I have left aside one important social group besides the nobles and farmers, the learned classes. These men were called the fili. There were two major kinds of fili, the poets and the lawyers. They had probably originally included the druids, but of course, after the conversion to Christianity, the druids dropped out of the equation. I have already discussed the poets in my lecture on Irish literature, so here I'll concentrate on the lawyers. Law in Ireland is very remarkable, and it forms its own subspecialty in early Irish history. We have lots of legal texts, and they seem to have been important enough to be recopied over and over in the same form. These texts seem to show an Ireland in which the legal system is uniform throughout the country. We don't know how early this became true, but one of the major signs of this is the fact that, unlike rank-and-file members of society, lawyers had free passage throughout the country. Like poets, they didn't need the permission of a king to enter his territory. Another sign of how important lawyers were is that after the conversion to Christianity, they survive as a distinct lay professional group. In most other parts of Europe, lawyers usually merged into the clergy, but in Ireland, law was a family tradition. Irish law was referred to by the English as Brehon law from the Irish word brithev, which means judge or jurist. Brehon law was one of the distinctively Irish institutions that the English later tried hard to eradicate. Irish law looks different from, say, the English common law because it is mostly lists of legal rules, not records of case law. So we know a lot about what the lawyers thought should happen, but not a lot about what did happen, with only a few exceptions. To see law in action, we usually have to look at what happens in stories. And law comes up enough in the stories to reinforce the importance of law to this society. Unlike the Anglo-Saxon kings, Irish kings were not lawgivers, at least in the early period, though that changed a little bit with the arrival of Christianity. On the other hand, the concept of the king's justice was crucial. If the king was just, the land would produce abundant crops. But if the king was seen to be unjust, the land would wither. So kings were supposed to act justly, but for this, they usually enlisted the aid of judges. And there's a wonderful text that illustrates this. It is called The Judgments of Caracnid, and it purports to record an exchange between King Conn Caid Cathach, Conn of the Hundred Battles, and his chief judge, Caracnid, in which the king goes through a list of all the times he thinks the judge issued a faulty ruling. And then Caracnid explains, in no uncertain terms, why he was actually right all along. So you can bet a lawyer wrote this. I want to mention one additional distinctively Irish institution that caused a culture clash with later English conquerors, namely distraint. Distraint was a recognized legal method of coercing someone into complying with the law. We think of the term distraint of trade. Here it means depriving someone of the ability to make use of their assets, usually cattle. So if someone owed you compensation and refused to pay, you could basically go and take the equivalent payment in actual cattle. Some of the cattle raiding, endemic in Ireland, was probably part of distraint. Not all, but certainly some. And it makes sense in a society with very little infrastructure that you would sometimes need to take the law into your own hands. And in fact, that was very much the way the legal system conceived of itself. This kind of self-help was another factor that made Irish society seem rather chaotic to outsiders such as the English. Another way one could obtain redress was to shame the offender into compliance by publicly fasting on his doorstep. This made a very public show out of refusing this person's hospitality, which was a rebuke to his honor. Now, at the time of the Irish War of Independence against the British in the 1910s and early 1920s, Irish nationalists very consciously revived this tradition with the hunger strike, as did the Irish Republican Army in Northern Ireland in the 1980s. The big difference being that we have no evidence in the early Irish texts that anyone ever actually fasted to death. There is one final topic I want to address in this lecture, and that is the status of women in Irish society. This is a huge topic, and it's very controversial among scholars. Some want to see the Celtic lands as a kind of paradise where women had greater rights than in other ancient societies. Scholars who want to argue this point to a couple of kinds of evidence. For instance, they note that women could initiate divorce themselves, which was not true in some other cultures. In both Wales and Ireland, temporary unions existed and could be dissolved without permanently damaging the reputation of the female partner. And we do see occasional references to women practitioners of the learned classes, women poets, women doctors, even a female satirist, as we've seen. It is also true that despite the fact that the normal rules of Irish property precluded the ownership of family property by women, there were clearly many instances in which women did own property. And this brings me to one of the figures most often cited when discussing the status of women in Ireland, namely Queen Maeve of Connacht, the great antagonist of the Ulstermen in the Toyne. The great cattle raid in that story is touched off when Maeve becomes jealous of a great bull owned by her husband Alil, and she wants to steal another bull to demonstrate her superiority. Maeve is queen of Connacht in her own right, by inheritance from her father, the High King of Ireland, and she is anything but shy about her status and her femininity. She casts doubt on Alil's masculine prowess, and she offers her sexual favors to pretty much anyone who will help her get what she wants. Some scholars who have looked at Maeve have assumed that any society that created a character like her must have regarded women as powerful, perhaps even as the equals of men. Now, women were very powerful in Irish folklore, and they were intimately associated with death. The battle goddess, the Morrigan, often signaled the death of a hero. The appearance of any banshee, or fairy woman, could be the sign of impending death or misfortune, and women had the special responsibility of keening for the dead, that is, wailing in mournful tones. The word keening comes from the Irish word for crying. But there is a lot of evidence for the subordinate status of women as well. We have lots of evidence for polygamy, at least among high-status individuals, and plenty of evidence for the sexual exploitation of women. The slave girls, who notionally served as a unit of value, were clearly available to their masters for that purpose, and St. Patrick even refers obliquely to the mortification that female converts felt when they were forced to engage in such acts with their masters. It is true that women could sometimes dissolve unhappy unions, but they would then return to the legal guardianship of their male relatives. What we probably see then is not a utopia for women, but a complicated picture in which some women managed to carve out niches for themselves within an otherwise male-dominated society. And that society was extremely complex, with a sophisticated legal system that regulated or attempted to regulate most aspects of social and economic life. It was culturally unified and resilient, even in the face of considerable political instability. But it was that instability that most struck the English, who observed these societies as conquerors, and that led those conquerors to determine that only the complete Anglicization of the Celtic countries could integrate them fully into civilized society.
Lecture 16, The Irish Sea World, Celts and Vikings.
Welcome back. In this lecture, I want to talk about a big topic, and it won't be exclusively Celtic. I want to talk about the complicated but fascinating interactions between the Celtic-speaking peoples and their neighbors all around the Irish Sea. We're talking here primarily about relations between the Celtic world and the Norse world, that is to say, the Vikings. So in this lecture, we'll be concentrating on the many ways in which these two worlds, each of which is extremely culturally rich in its own right, interacted with each other, both peacefully and not so peacefully. We'll be covering a relatively long time span here, ranging from the 8th century down to comparatively modern times, but I think it's worth it to follow the whole story. We'll see that the impact of the Vikings on the various Celtic-speaking areas differed considerably. Some areas were substantially transformed by their encounter with the Vikings. Other areas were barely affected at all. We'll be concentrating on the two areas where the Vikings had the most lasting effects, Ireland and Scotland. Now, the Vikings also had a substantial impact on Brittany, but Brittany was part of a different set of trading contacts and cultural ties, so I'll keep the focus on the Irish Sea. Since we already know quite a bit about the Celtic peoples by now, I want to say a few words about the Vikings, who of course deserve plenty of attention in their own right. The name Viking is not technically an ethnic name at all. It's more of a description of an occupation. To go a Viking meant to go out raiding. Most of the people who we call Vikings would have just called themselves Norsemen or Danes or something like that. But the name Viking has now become traditional, and I don't think it's worth fighting the trend. So the Vikings appeared on the scene in the late 8th century when small groups of raiders began attacking coastal settlements in the northern parts of the islands of Britain and Ireland. The most famous such raid took place in 793 in Lindisfarne, off the east coast of the Anglian kingdom of Northumbria. We know a lot about this raid because news of the raid made it to the court of the German king and future emperor, Charlemagne. And one of Charlemagne's close advisors was an Englishman named Alcuin, who wrote a powerful